Today at Reader's Corner, Tom Nichols, author of The Death of Expertise, The Campaign Against Established Knowledge and Why It Matters. I'm Bob Custer. Welcome to Reader's Corner. Thanks to technological advances like the internet, we have access to more information than ever before. Gone are the days when we argued at length with friends over a piece of trivia. Instead, we pull out our smartphones and instantly get the answer. But as Tom Nichols explains in his book, The Death of Expertise, this information isn't making us any smarter. In fact, it's turning us into an army of ill-informed and angry citizens who denounce intellectual achievement and distrust experts. Today we're featuring an encore edition of our interview with Tom Nichols. He is a professor of national security affairs at the U.S. Naval War College, an adjunct professor at the Harvard Extension School, and a former aide in the U.S. Senate. He's written 5 books on international relations, Russian affairs, and nuclear weapons, and is a senior contributor for The Federalist. In addition, Dr. Nichols is an undefeated 5-time Jeopardy champion. He joins us today by phone for this interview. Tom Nichols, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thanks, Bob. Thanks for having me.
Boy, Tom, I'd love to spend some time talking about Jeopardy, but I think we have a book to review here, so I don't want to take time away from the hard work you put into this book, but congratulations on that feat. That's saying something.
Thank you.
And in any event, let's start with the basics, and I don't know, maybe I even wonder whether I should start with the basic question, but in this era of attacks on expertise, help us understand the expert. In your book, you spend some time talking about the conditions of expertise. What qualifies an expert to be an expert? What distinguishes the expert from the faux expert, let's say?
A lot of people claim to be experts, and a lot of folks use the term pretty loosely to mean, you know, almost anybody who kind of puts themselves forward that way. But in the book, I talk about several aspects of what it takes to become an expert. And I think one mistake most people make is that it's just credentialing, that, you know, if you have a PhD or if you're an MD or if you went to college, and it's much more complex than that. I argue in the book that credentialing and training is an important part of it, not just academic credentialing. If you think about it, what makes a master electrician? Well, first, somebody had to teach that trade to a young apprentice and then move on forward. So there's the initial entry of education or training or apprenticeship. And then there's longevity. People who aren't good at things don't tend to last very long in it. There's also, and I think this is really important, peer review. And again, not just the kind of academic peer review, but again, within trades, within guilds. Professors are tenured by the review of other professors. Doctors are admitted to boards on the say-so of other doctors. And this is really a tough eye of the needle to get through. And I think people out there tend to underestimate that. They think it's tends to be more of a handshake or a backslap, and it's actually quite difficult. There's also the indefinable quantity of talent, that there are people who are experts, but they're not very good experts. So we have this kind of final cut of people that are merely competent at something and people who are really great at it. There are dentists who are just merely competent dentists, and then there are other dentists who are talented surgeons and dental experts. So there's a whole constellation of things that make for an expert. And in the end, these are the people that we consider their knowledge to be authoritative. The way I always put it is, in your daily life, if you had to ask someone for advice on a complicated problem, the person you would think to ask is probably the expert on that.
Now, let's get to the title of your book then. If that's expertise, then what is the death of expertise?
Well, it's really the death of the idea of expertise, because there are always going to be experts. There are always going to be lawyers. There are always going to be doctors and engineers and professors and diplomats and people who have well-defined skills. When I talk about the death of expertise, I'm talking about the death of the idea that expertise should matter in the way people live their lives. For example, there are doctors and scientists and virologists and epidemiologists who tell you that you should vaccinate your children. We now live in an age where people say, no, I'm smarter than a doctor. I can replace that expertise. I don't need to listen to people who have done this their whole lives and work in laboratories and have degrees in this. I can step forward. And I should add that I'm not decrying here questioning experts. I really think that's important. I think people should ask their doctors probing questions. I think, you know, if your government tells, and I should add, by the way, I don't speak for the U.S. government or for the Navy, but if your government tells you, you know, we have to negotiate an arms treaty, that you should read the paper and you should ask probing questions. Is this important to my country? You know, if the government says we have to raise taxes or lower taxes, of course people should question what they're hearing. The reason I wrote the book is that people now step forward and argue that they can replace those experts. That instead of saying, look, I want you to explain this tax policy to my satisfaction because I have some questions, people say, I've got this. I understand tax policy, or I understand healthcare, or I understand nuclear weapons as well as an expert does. I started writing this. I'm a Russia expert by training. I went to the Russian Institute of Columbia. I learned Russian, all of that stuff. And where I sat down to start writing about this was the day someone had said to me for, you know, the 100th time, Tom, I disagree with you and I don't think you understand Russia. Let me explain Russia to you. And that's when I kind of stepped back and said, we really have a problem here with the way people regard expertise. And that's where the title came from.
So it's one thing to have a low level of information about a subject and step into a conversation and proceed to explain to someone that you know more about it than anybody else. It's another thing when there's actual hostility to the idea of having more information or more knowledge. And I wonder if you could help us talk through that, because in your book, I know you address the fact that it's not just the lack of expertise, but it's the fact that some folks really seem to thrive or are hostile about the fact that they are ignorant.
That's definitely on the rise in the past 20 or 30 years, and it's very disturbing. The word I use to get at the root of all of this, including that hostility, is narcissism. That we've become a culture of people who simply cannot tolerate ever to be told that we're wrong about anything. And we see this in classrooms, we see it on social media, we see it in public debate, we see it on cable television, where people simply cannot accept debate, argument, correction of any kind, that we have all become advocates of our own self-esteem, that our public interactions are all about self-actualization and reassuring ourselves rather than hearing other people. And this becomes especially difficult when experts are trying to reason with people who don't know what they're talking about, because it becomes very personal. As I say in the book, people no longer see a difference between you're wrong and you're stupid. And they take every form of correction as a personal attack on themselves. When in an earlier time, I think most people went into most discussions understanding that we have a division of labor for a reason. Most of us don't know everything. Most of us can't hit to all fields like that. But that's changed dramatically. And I think it's part of the general kind of ill temper that has seized America over the past several decades when it comes to matters like this.
Let's talk about our conversations with each other in what you call the confirmation bias. Tell us about that.
Confirmation bias is a well-known psychological phenomenon, and it affects all of us. It affects you and me and anyone we talk to, because we're human beings. It's the way our brain works. And it refers to the problem that when you believe something, you cherry pick evidence from the world around you that will confirm that belief. That's why it's called confirmation bias. If you think that all drivers in Idaho are bad drivers, then the next time you're in Idaho, you say, boy, I remember that guy who cut me off. You will never remember the three other guys who waved you through an intersection or who stopped at a yellow light for you. You'll just think of it in the way you need to think of it so that you're not wrong. The other example I use in the book is, if you think left-handed people are evil, as we once used to, because of course that's where sinister comes from, then every left-handed criminal that you see will confirm your belief that left-handed people are bad. All law-abiding left-handed people, you'll never notice them because your brain filters those out. And so that really rules people these days, where they cherry pick that evidence. And again, it's a normal human thing, but with so much information, there's a huge buffet that people can pick from that does nothing but solidify their confirmation bias every day, all day long.
You're listening to Reader's Corner, and I'm talking today with Tom Nichols, author of The Death of Expertise, The Campaign Against Established Knowledge and Why It Matters. What's the Dunning-Kruger effect?
There's no nice way to put the Dunning-Kruger effect, named for the social psychologists who discovered and named it. Basically, the Dunning-Kruger effect is the problem that the dumber you are, the less likely you are to know that you're dumb. That the worse you are at something, the less likely you are to know that you're bad at it. And Dunning and Kruger are a little gentler about this. They refer to them as the less competent. That people who are less competent at things tend to be less competent precisely because they can't recognize their own incompetence. Examples of this would be people like writers who are just, I think everybody's met someone who says, oh, you know, you wrote a book, you know, my mom's working on a book, or I've always wanted to write a novel, because they don't understand that they're not very good writers because they can't see it. They can't look at a page and read a paragraph or two of text and say, boy, this really stinks. You know, the grammar is poor, or it's not very clear, or, you know, I'm not using particularly good diction or imagery. The way I always explain it to people in their daily life is, you know, that one guy when you go to karaoke and he steps up there and he's terrible, and then he steps off the stage and he says, nailed it, right? We're all that guy about something. Older people tend to overestimate their ability to drive, for example. Students tend to overestimate their grades on an exam. You know, golfers, I play golf, we're the biggest liars in the world, especially to ourselves, about how good we are. But this becomes a problem in dealing with expertise when you have a society of people who increasingly now say, no, no, I am an expert in many things, or I can talk with experts in many things, when in fact, these are people who are not recognizing their own limitations or their own ability to know that they don't know things. And that becomes a very difficult conversation.
Why do I think our listeners are now thinking about somebody or the current state of political affairs that this applies to? But we're going to move right on and talk about the internet. Tell us, Tom, how you see this glut of information that we now get from so many different sources, and especially the internet. The chapter, I think, is called Let Me Google It, something like that. Tell us what impact that has. Almost the opposite effect of what you would think, instead of making us smarter, dumber, as you say.
Yes. And I should add here that at the risk of being perceived as, you know, just a cranky old guy who doesn't like computers, I'm a computer geek. You know, I assemble some of my own stuff, and I was an early adopter of the internet because the internet came of age when I was in my 20s. I am a huge fan of connectivity and conversation and globalization and global information, all of that stuff. I think that's great. I think it's great that the world is connected that way. Unfortunately, it's kind of like the invention of gunpowder, which has made it possible to do a lot of things, and most of them are bad because of the way people use this resource now. And I think we kind of passed the tipping point with the internet where instead of adding to our knowledge, it became just endless flaming dumpsters of nonsense that were put there for various reasons, whether it's profit by corporations, whether it's political organizations, terrorists, there are even terrorists putting web pages on the internet, as well as, you know, well-meaning students or friends who are putting up web pages. I had a blog for some years, and I actually took it down because I realized that blogs were becoming part of the problem. And so rather than people approaching this like a huge farmer's market of food, they're approaching it like a huge food court in a mall full of junk. And I would say they're hurting themselves more than helping themselves. The other problem with the big global connectivity of the internet is that, again, it lets people indulge that confirmation bias. If you believe in something ridiculous, no matter how ridiculous it is, the internet guarantees you that you will find the one other person in the world who actually has the same completely kooky idea that you do. And that you can reach out and touch that small community of people and say, see, I'm not incompetent or crazy or dumb because there's five other people in the world who agree with me. When in fact, there's always, I mean, if you scour the face of the earth, you can always find enough people that will agree with you no matter how wrong you are. You can always find a group of people who think the world is flat, but that doesn't mean anything. So unfortunately, I think the internet, while a great step forward for humanity, has also been a great step backward in the knowledge and the ability to understand basic facts for the average person.
There's a number of places in your book where you talk about the disengagement of the public, the lack of knowledge about the political system in which we live and operate. In fact, maybe we'll just start with a very basic one. At one point, you talk about voters and citizens in general who really don't understand the difference between a republic and a democracy. Why don't you just run through that for us?
Sure. Part of the problem is that I think because so much of how the world is run, from keeping the lights on to, you know, making email arrive or using, you know, Amazon or UPS or whatever, most of that is so transparent to people that they just don't think about it. And I think this does lead to disengagement from a lot of things. I think one of the culprits that I point to in the book is affluence. And that has filtered down to politics. We just had an election that I think most of us would agree, no matter which side of this you were on, was one of the most divisive elections in modern American history. And yet only 60% of the eligible voters even showed up. And that is a really terrifying problem. Because again, people don't understand that the people you elect have to make a whole bunch of decisions based on expert knowledge. You don't have to understand every issue walking into the voting booth, but you do need to have faith that the people you're voting for have good people they can listen to. And this is where the difference between a republic and a democracy comes in. Disaffected or alienated voters say, well, democracy doesn't work because my voice isn't directly heard on any range of these expert issues that I happen to feel strongly about, whether I know anything about them or not. The fact of the matter is the United States is not a direct democracy. It's a republic. We elect people to then use their judgment in addition to our instructions. We don't send people to Washington merely as radio transmitters that we're speaking into at home, that then our voices are magnified on the floor of the House. We're asking those representatives to talk with experts, to hire staff, and then to make decisions using their judgment along with what we expect them to do to reach good policy. When people disengage from that and simply say, look, just do what I want, even though I don't understand the issues, you're going to get completely incoherent policy. And I think the complete mess in the Senate that erupted over and in the House over things like healthcare reform, that's a good example of that, because you have a bunch of people trying to execute conflicting ideas all at the same time. That doesn't make for coherent policy. And I think when people disengage, an example I use in the book, by the way, is foreign aid. The president campaigned on cutting foreign aid. The problem is, if you talk to most people in America, they will tell you that foreign aid, they think foreign aid is anywhere from 10 to 25% of the U.S. budget, when in fact it's 0.75%. So, you know, it's kind of difficult to say, well, how would you like us to cut this when you are already wrong about how much you think is being spent? And I think that leads to paralysis and incoherence in a republic. We can't just solve everything by being a democracy and all showing up in the public square and having a plebiscite. The Brits tried that with Brexit, and to this day, they're still wrestling with the outcome of that. Mm-hmm. And we're not set up for that. Our Constitution, in fact, is specifically designed to prohibit that kind of behavior because we're a federal republic. So this is really a danger to our way of life when people reject expertise and disengage from knowing even basic things about politics.
This is Bob Custer, and I'm talking with Tom Nichols about his book, The Death of Expertise. The book explores how a wealth of information actually causes us to reject expert opinions. As I read in your book what you just said in the answer to this last question, I opened up that higher ed chapter and I thought, I know where he's going now. He's going to address the issue of whether or not the undergraduate curriculum today is indeed one that educates citizens for the democracy, the republic in which we live. And you even mentioned Brown University, and I thought, aha, he landed on the perfect example, Brown's open curriculum, which says on its website, the only specific curricular requirements at Brown are that all students must successfully complete 30 courses in 8 semesters. Do whatever you want, however you want. And I can say in my experience over the years in higher education, I've seen more and more efforts to loosen up the curriculum, especially I'm focusing now on the core curriculum. And I just wondered what your thoughts are on that. I was a little surprised that you didn't take that on. In fact, some of the things you took on, I have to say that I think you generalized or stereotyped the way you suggest we all do as readers and listeners. But again, I really, really have an issue with this question of whether or not we're still providing the basic core knowledge students should have leaving an undergraduate education. What's your thoughts on that?
We're not. That's the problem. I didn't take on the individual curricula of various schools because, first, those change from year to year. And I was much more concerned with the overall problem of the self-esteem issue and the problem of grade inflation and the fact that a lot of students are graduating from college thinking they have a college education, and it makes them more resistant to learning when, in fact, they really don't have a college-level education. Now, with that said, the other reason I didn't go after, you know, the various curricula around the country is I still think American universities are the best in the world. I still think there's a reason that the world beats down our door to get into our colleges and universities. And I think that we can't throw the baby out with the bathwater. But when students are being treated as clients, when they're being recruited purely to come and turn on a tap of endless loan money, it makes it very difficult to put them through the rigorous steps of education that require critical thinking that leaves them with the ability to become lifetime learners. And so I think one of the most valuable things you gain in college is not the on-the-shelf knowledge of, you know, the atomic number of boron or, you know, how many amendments to the Constitution at a given time, but that you develop a habit of critical thinking and of intellectual curiosity that then carries you on past your 20s or your early 30s. And I think that that's being lost to make students basically feel better about themselves and to encourage students to think of college as a place like home and an experience rather than to learn. When I realized looking around most universities that you could graduate from a good school with a liberal arts degree, having never read Shakespeare, the Bible, or the American Constitution, I started to wonder exactly what it is, you know, we're doing, especially with undergraduate education. So I share your concerns. I just think there's a bigger problem that universities are now oriented around what students want rather than what students need and what universities have the responsibility to teach them.
Yeah. I just think that varies greatly from campus to campus. We just revised our core curriculum, which had gotten a little bit out of hand, a lot of psychobabble, and not enough of what I would call the canon. And we simply changed it. And the interesting thing, you know, you take after your helicopter parents a little bit. The helicopter parents were some of the first people to figure it out. And the reason they figured it out is because they went to school. They're in their 40s and their early 50s. And they went to school back when life was exactly for the undergraduate experience the way it was for you and the way it was for me.
Well, that's why I didn't single out any particular institutions for their curriculum, because the one place faculty can make a relatively speedy change, and of course, you know, in our business, relatively speedy is 2 to 3 years as a window. I didn't want to kind of tag any one institution as saying this curriculum, because a year or two later, it might not be true.
Right.
And I do tag helicopter parents, especially at elite schools, because this becomes a family kind of enterprise to get the student admitted to that school. And once admitted, the idea that the student isn't going to do well is almost incomprehensible to at least some parents. Mm-hmm. And that does affect the way higher education reacts to the needs of students. And I think this is a significant problem. I don't want elite schools to fall to that any more than I want public education to become nothing more than trade school. That's a danger.
Sure. Let me address one other issue you raised in that chapter. Too many students who are in college don't belong in college. And then in the concluding chapter, you do a great job of pointing out a one-man campaign against established knowledge. That's the Trump campaign. And how Trump's strongest support came from people with low levels of education. And at one point, you even quoted him as saying, "I love the poorly educated." By the time I finished your book, I thought, my gosh, I think this guy would be looking for ways to bring more Latinos into the university, more Asian and African Americans, and finding ways of bringing underrepresented groups into higher education who might be in high schools right now here in Idaho who are really struggling and who many people have given up on. Your thoughts?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think that conflates two separate things, which is more diversity in higher education and the larger issue that I was raising of the insane idea that everybody in America should go to college. I think when it comes to the Trump campaign, we were talking about people who I would argue are, even though they're high school graduates, are not particularly well educated. And I don't want colleges to have to step in and do what high schools should have been doing all along. And I think that's a problem, because when the answer becomes everybody should go to college, I mean, this is where every time Bernie Sanders or before that Barack Obama would say it, my head would explode. That just means that high schools will then become daycare until 18, and as some of them are becoming, and then offload their problems to a whole armada of new colleges, which, as I point out in the book, now insist on calling themselves universities, even if they're tiny. And that then they will offload the basic problems of teaching students to read and write to the college level, which is really not what college is for. I'm trying to hold that line so that high schools will do their job and parents will let high schools do their job, so that we don't need to send everybody to, of course, we're on radio, so no one can see me doing it, but air quotes college. I think what's also interesting is that Trump did very well among people who reported some college, which to me was a revealing statistic that I think somebody should delve more into, because I think there are a lot of angry people who started college, either couldn't pay for it or didn't like it or were underserved by a poor local school and are bitter about what they see as an educated class walking around with credentials that don't mean very much. And sometimes they're right, but I don't think anybody should argue that college is the answer for everyone, because I think that creates all kinds of secondary problems and doesn't really make sense. There are kids that shouldn't go to college and wouldn't be happy in college and would do better going to work. But I think it's almost kind of propaganda to tell students that unless they go to college, they're somehow failures. And I really think we need to walk that back, because it's dragging down the value of a college degree. It's turning colleges into glorified high schools, and it's bankrupting an entire generation of students who really should get their lives started and get to work.
So tell us what role the new journalism plays in the death of expertise.
Well, this is the double-edged sword of, we have a wonderful ability now to have several journalistic outlets. We no longer are beholden to three old white guys paid by corporations in New York telling us what the news is for 26 minutes. And I think that's a good thing. I think more diversity in our information space, more diversity of voices that are being heard in the media, more diversity of people that we see on television. But that also means that there's so much bandwidth to fill that, again, much like universities, the media are now serving the public as a client rather than as a public service informing us what we need to know. One thing about those evening newscasts 30 or 40 years ago, yes, it was a curated stream of information from corporations in New York. It was also a curated stream that said, this arms control treaty or this tax bill or this important political event is more important than which celebrity is sleeping with whom. And somehow we overshot the mark away from that model to infotainment, where you can now watch a differently curated stream of media all day long. If you're conservative, you can watch Fox. If you're liberal, you watch MSNBC. If you're liberal, you read the Huffington Post. If you're conservative, you read the Weekly Standard. You don't ever have to encounter a differing viewpoint ever. Certainly not in a day of normal media consumption.
You no longer have to encounter what I would call a middle-of-the-road viewpoint.
No, nowhere. Because who wants to listen to that? That's not fun. That's not gladiatorial. And so as a result, we simply leave the news on all day long as kind of wallpaper that talks back to us and never tells us anything we don't agree with.
Very interesting. Experts are wrong sometimes, aren't they? What happens
then?
We're
wrong often. We're just not likely to be wrong as often as you are, is what I always tell lay people. Right. Yes, we're wrong. And we get things wrong in our subject. We're just more likely to be right than you. And I think the most important thing about expert failure is to be transparent about it. And I think this is where experts fall down on the job sometimes.
Well, this has been great. I really appreciate your being with us today, Tom. Again, the name of the book is The Death of Expertise, The Campaign Against Established Knowledge and Why It Matters by Tom Nichols. Tom, thanks so much for joining us today at Reader's Corner.
Thanks so much for having me.
I hope you enjoyed this encore edition of our interview with Tom Nichols. Next week, Sally Bedell Smith, author of Prince Charles, The Passions and Paradoxes of an Improbable Life. Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research by Brady Moore.
Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.